Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Elmo Hernandez. He is the president of the Fundación Ludwig de Cuba, the Ludwig Foundation of Cuba, and Stuart Ashman joins us. He is Cabinet Secretary for Cultural Affairs for the State of New Mexico. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thanks.
So, Elmo, you have been invited here by Stuart Ashman, by the State of New Mexico, to talk about this Ludwig Foundation. What is this foundation?
Well, first of all, I would love to say that I don't speak English.
Oh, yes, you do.
Which means that I will make a lot of mistakes.
That's okay.
Please forgive me. And if you understand what I'm trying to say, it's good. Okay. Now, second, a foundation is something very normal in the States, but it's not like this in Cuba. I mean, we only have six foundations in Cuba. The six of them are connected with the culture. And among these six foundations, we are the only one that receive all the financial support from abroad.
From abroad.
Mainly from the Ludwig Foundation in Germany. Peter Ludwig was a great art collector in the second half of the 20th century. And he got interested in Cuban art in 1990 exactly, when he saw a Cuban exhibition of young Cuban artists at the Kunsthallen, the city of Dusseldorf. The title was Cuba OK. I mean, that was the same year when the Berlin Wall fell down.
Right.
So, starting with the title, everything was very ironic in that exhibition. But it was a very critical exhibition. My German friends were very surprised with this kind of Cuban art. They said at the very beginning, it must be dissident art in Cuba. But at the same time, said, the government is sending the exhibition. How come it's going to be dissident? So they got surprised, and Ludwig got very interested. He wanted to buy the whole exhibition. He couldn't, so he started to travel to Cuba, and for several years we were working together, creating what is now the Cuban art collection in the Ludwig collection, which is a collection, a huge private collection, that is spread in more than 30 museums all over the world. Not only in Europe, but including one in Beijing and one in St. Petersburg in Russia, and another one in Budapest, Hungary. In this side of the world, the Ludwig Foundation of Cuba is the only Ludwig institution that we have. So coming back to the situation in Cuba, we were created in 1995, in the middle of a very difficult moment for the Cuban society.
Well, I was going to say, 1990, when this exhibition went to Cuba, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of Soviet support for Cuba, the beginning of the so-called special period, a lot of poverty, a lot of suffering in Cuba.
Absolutely. Whenever I talk with any American friends, I said to them, you can see that ordinary life is very difficult in Cuba, and you know that, Charlotte. But you simply couldn't imagine how difficult it was at the beginning of the 90s. Because we lost the support, the financial support from the Soviet Union, and we still have right now, the American embargo.
Right.
So it couldn't be more difficult, because also we had a lack of hope. We didn't know where to go at all. But nothing is in black and white. In my opinion, this was the worst moment in the entire Cuban history, but at the same time, the best moment. Why? Because we were finally alone at last.
And very interesting.
And that made the country had to change a lot. If you ask me, I have never seen any other place in the world that have been changing so much and so fast as we have been changing in the last 20 years, just in order to survive, to be able to survive. And we have been changing for good, and for bad, but changing. Changing always, every day.
And is that change reflected in the contemporary art?
A lot. Because that's another thing very important to understand about Cuba. Why Cuba didn't fall together with the Soviet Union and all the other East European countries, okay, because Cuba wasn't an East European country. In fact, if you ask my personal opinion, in 1958, from my personal point of view, Cuba was the most American country in the world outside the United States. Not only the closest country from a geographical point of view, but culturally talking, the in a very deep way, the most American country. So,
what do you mean by that? The most American country?
Oh well, let's put the things like this. The 20th century was a very special moment for the Cuban history, because at the end of the 19th century, we finally had our independence war, organized by José Martí. That was somebody that spent the last 15 years of his life in New York, working as a journalist. You almost could say that he was like a New Yorker in several ways. But he was fighting for the independence in Cuba, which was, since the very beginning, the most important goal for the Cubans that were fighting with him for the independence. At the end of the war, the Americans came into the war, Cuba became a republic only in 1902. A lot of historians love to say that we became a kind of colony of the United States, which I don't think is the truth. I think the truth is that by that time, the big corporations, the big American corporations, started to become very powerful. And Cuba, in fact, in my opinion, was also the place in which these corporations rehearsed for the first time what we now call globalization.
What were some of those corporations? Like, what kinds of things were they making and doing?
Cuba was a big sugar producer, so they started to produce sugar. We are talking about the United Fruit Company, Cuban Telephone Company, ATT, Cuban Telephone Company, then energy. They developed the energy. The whole infrastructure in the country was destroyed after the war. So these corporations developed their business in Cuba, producing sugar, producing nickel, producing electricity, some business connected with communications. And mainly at the cultural level, the mass culture was introduced more and more in Cuba, which was before a very European country, and become little by little a much more North American country. Meanwhile, the avant-garde Cuban artists traveled to Europe and developed a kind of resistant movement, which I could say that the Cuban avant-garde movement in the arts, in the music, and in the literature was a lot, a kind of resistance against this kind of massive culture that was being introduced. But
resistance against?
Against this kind of banalization of the culture, etc. And
through the kind of corporate globalization and the culture that brought with
exactly,
it.
Exactly, exactly. I'm sorry about my bad English.
No. I'm just trying to understand it.
Okay. Perfect. I'm apologizing. But nevertheless, in the 50s already, let me tell you that these people that was the avant-garde culture in Cuba, they were a very, very small group of people, and they were absolutely marginalized from the official culture in the country. I know this very well because my father was an actor. So I grew up in the middle of this movement too. But in the 50s, the influence started to come from the United States. I'm talking about the abstract expressionism in the arts, about the Stanislavski ideas in the theater that came through the influence of Lee Strasberg and the Actors Studio in Cuba, into Cuba. I'm talking about the development of the Cuban ballet, or the development of the Cuban contemporary dance. Alicia Alonso was the star of the American Ballet Theater at that time, as everybody knows. That's why we have a big ballet movement in Cuba.
Right.
And other dancers were influenced, strongly influenced by Martha Graham and other people here in the United States, and came back. But listen, this is what we could call the high level of the culture in the country. In the other level, we had the best television that existed in the world, Only in the United States, you had the same kind of television that we had in Cuba.
What did you have?
We have a lot of channels, television channels, and we saw all the programs that you saw here.
So
we
like
produced the programs here, and we saw the same programs in Cuba. We had, at the beginning of the revolution, even color TV in Cuba already.
Well, you know, to add to that, I remember growing up in Cuba and seeing all the American shows there.
I mean, was it I Love Lucy in translation? I mean, is that what you're talking about?
Yes, that and Highway Patrol with Broderick Crawford and the Andy Griffith Show.
The
and
Sheriff of Cochise.
The Sheriff of Cochise, that's right, with his 57 Chrysler. And all of those things. In fact, as an aside, you know, the Cuban street slang word for Americans is not gringos, as they say in Mexico, but it's Yuma. And that comes from the TV show The Rebel with Nick Adams. Johnny Yuma was a rebel, and that's where it
La
comes
Yuma.
From.
La Yuma, I never knew why
La
we were
Yuma.
Called that.
Because of
you
that
must know that, because you must know something else. You know what Yuma means for the young people in Cuba? The best.
That's
so
right.
They call you the
that's
best.
Right. That's right.
When they try to say that a woman is very pretty, they say it's Yuma.
And La Yuma.
She's very American.
It's La Yuma.
Very American, right?
Yeah.
So we're talking to Elmo Hernandez of the Ludwig Foundation. He's here visiting from Cuba, and Stuart Ashman, Cabinet Secretary for Cultural Affairs. So you're painting a picture of a very cosmopolitan island. I don't know if it's the whole island or if it's primarily Havana that you're talking about, but a place in which American, North American culture has a very strong effect. European culture has a very strong effect. And of course, Cuba has its own culture that developed, its Afro-Cuban culture that is also extremely strong.
Okay, so Cuba is an island, okay? An island with ports. And this makes a big difference. The ports were very important in all of history. So our culture was built from dialogues mainly, but we have to take in consideration that we had a slavery, unfortunately. And not only slavery, but Cuban wealthy came from trading human beings from Africa. So this makes the Cuban culture a very particular one, melting point in several ways. So then, with the success of the revolution in 1958, what we mainly achieved, in my opinion, was the idea of the independence for the first time in the history. And this is an abstraction, okay? Just like democracy is an abstraction, freedom is an abstraction, etc. But this was, and still is, in my opinion, the most important abstraction for the Cuban people. Among all the possible Cubas at the end of the 19th century, the one that Martí created is still the one about we are dreaming about. Still
so
now.
You've talked about kind of three levels of this. I mean, the Cuban Revolution at the beginning of the 20th century, then 1958, the revolution then, well, the independence at the beginning, then 1958, and then 1990, freedom from the Soviet Union.
Exactly. Now, but let me tell you something. In the 60s, the cultural policy, what we call the Cuban cultural policy, was developed. And this made a big difference between Cuba and the East European countries. Why? Because one of the main principles of this cultural policy was that we will remain always being a Western country, part of the Western world. And what's the main role for the arts and the intellectuals in the Western culture is to be part of the critical consciousness of the society, if I could say that. Not only that, we will never accept a kind of official style like socialist realism, as the Stalinistic people established in the other socialist countries in the world. So our cultural policy, among a lot of other things, made us a very different place than these so-called East European countries. And that's why, in my opinion, the Cuban culture has played a very important role in the last 50 years, and mainly in the last 20 years, being very critical towards the society, showing what has to be changed, showing what the bad things are, etc.
You were talking about the exhibition that went to Germany in 1990 that attracted the attention of Peter Ludwig, and that was already dissident artists, and that was before the special period really got underway, the very difficult period. How did art and critical art develop in the 1990s and up to the present, and have artists continued to really truly be free to say what they wanted to say?
Okay, let me tell you something. First of all, perhaps it was my personal mistake because of my bad English. They were not dissident artists. That's what the Germans thought, because they were very critical. They were artists that have been studied at the Cuban art schools. As you know, the country have a lot of art schools, and the Cuban society is not an homogeneous society. You will find a million different ways of thinking among the people that is supporting the revolution itself. So all these years, a very critical art, a very critical culture have been developed in Cuba. This was one of the main characteristics of the very well-developed arts, the very well-developed music, the very well-developed dance in the country, and even the literature. So I think that the exhibition in Germany wasn't an exception. Nevertheless, among the different opinions that you will find in Cuba, you will always find conservative people that try to avoid this kind of criticism in the art. So a big fight, making a very strong simplification, I could say that we had always two main groups fighting, one against the other. Those that wanted Cuba to follow the path of the Soviet Union, to follow the path of the Stalinistic people, or all the group that wanted Cuba to find its own way to change the society, to make the revolution. Let's call this second group the liberal group, the liberal people. And in the cultural field, most of the time, these people have been more powerful than the conservative people, the dogmatic people. And that's why if you see the whole conservative of the Cuban arts at the National Museum in Cuba, you will see a lot of examples since the 60s with a very critical point of view, showing a very critical point of view towards the society. After the 90s, it became even more critical because the young artists started to talk more and more about the problems that the society was facing. And besides that, the market was developed in Cuba after the 90s. So the artists could start to survive selling their works in dollars at the very beginning, because the economy was dollarized. You just can't say that in English? Dollarized, yeah. At that time. We started to have dollars. Right now, we have two currencies in Cuba, CUCs, which means more or less a little bit like dollars, and Cuban money, which is the Cuban peso, in which we receive our salaries. But one CUC means for 24 Cuban pesos.
Right.
And my salary could be more or less 500 Cuban pesos per month. You can
do
make
the
your
math,
account.
Ladies and gentlemen.
It's very difficult to understand how a Cuban
Nobody
can survive.
Understands
it's a very,
how
it's a very, it's a very unique situation all over the world.
Right.
But nevertheless, the cultural institutions in Cuba and the support of the government to the artists and to the culture, to the artistic education in Cuba have been so strong that during these very difficult years, the artists have developed a very strong movement, not only in the visual arts, but also in the music, in the dance, in the literature, etc. So,
you know, the other thing that's very important is that a Cuban artistic production is not just for museums and for the few people that are interested in the arts. When there is a major exhibit in Cuba, everybody goes. Workers, young people, old people, even if it's the first time that they've seen anything like this, and they're open-minded to the art in a way that's different. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that there hasn't been a market. You know, one of the things that you you see in the United States, for example, if you go to a fine art gallery in Santa Fe and there's a painting and it's just a green canvas and the price is $15,000, immediately the viewer dismisses it. They say, $15,000? I could do that.
Right.
Well, if you remove the monetary value to it, then you can go and look at that painting and say, isn't that interesting? A green canvas. What does he mean by this? Is he talking about the environment? Is he talking about being sick to my stomach?
Right.
What does green mean? Exactly. And so the public is very open to what happens in the arts. And the messages that are being delivered, the critical messages, are not necessarily blatant. They're not, you know, somebody doing a picture showing a political leader in a bad light. It's all between the lines.
Well, they use metaphor and they use very creative imagery, as in the wonderful exhibition that was at the National Hispanic Cultural Center earlier in the year, which I hope at least some of our listeners got to see, which was every strain, apparently, of Cuban contemporary art. It was stunning.
Yeah, exactly. And it is more sort of the traditional, you almost want to say old European model of the artist and the intellectual as being the barometer of culture and society. So the role of the artist in Cuba is very important and is recognized by the community as such.
I noticed when I was there, I started going in the late 1990s, 1999, and for several years after that, I kept on going back to Cuba, and even the popular music there by Los Van Van and Isaac Delgado and Manolito y Su Trabuco and all those people, they were much more sophisticated and creative and diverse within their own styles than the equivalent, even the most wonderful Puerto Rican salsa, which was really formulaic and made for the market to a certain length and to a certain style and so on. And I was thinking, you know, it's precisely the non-commercial world in which they're living that allows the creativity to flourish even in music.
I think that's the truth. And I think I don't have anything against market. We have to learn how to survive with the market, too. Because no way to live without the market in the present world. So I think that we are trying to develop from the foundation, because I didn't say anything about the foundation yet. We started mainly working with the artists that at that time were not very well known through the market, as they are now, some of them. But as the market came into Cuba, it was the art market, as you know, is one of the most sophisticated markets in the world. So there's nothing wrong with it, as you said, just said about that. But you need to know how to handle the market, how to work with that market. You need expertise towards that market, and we didn't have at that time.
And so that's what the foundation provided.
No. We tried. But at the same time, what happened with these artists in Cuba in most cases, in some cases, was that once they found a formula that was successful in the market, they would repeat the same formula until the end of the days. So we started to try to work mainly with emerging artists, developing a different point of view, even dealing with the markets, trying to develop the experimental work, the work that was directed to the Cuban new audiences, not to the customers that came from abroad to buy the works, but encouraging the art to play the same role that they have been played during 50 years in the country. I mean, talking with the young Cuban audiences, presenting their problems, making them think about their own problems, and developing a new sense of beauty always, trying to develop a new sense of beauty. We could be talking about art, we could be talking about dance, we could be talking about music, talking in general about Cuban culture. Again, my personal opinion is that we are people that dance. That's what we mainly do, dance. But that's why Cuban music is very well connected, especially the popular music, with rhythm, because it's connected with dance, with the way people dance. The dancers oblige the musicians to change the music all the time. And the same happened with the theater, the same happened with even in the literature, the poetry, the Cuba poetry, the rhythm is very important. As you know very well, after the revolution, after the during the 60s, the Cuban government developed a lot of art schools all over the country. So it's a lot of art education all over the country. And one thing I could say about the Cuban population right now is that mainly it's a highly education highly educated population. Living in very difficult conditions, receiving very low salaries, with a lot of problems, a lot of things to change. But we are talking about people highly educated. And this is perhaps one of the reasons why they can enjoy exhibitions, they can enjoy good music, they can enjoy good dancers, they can enjoy good things to read, they even can enjoy poetry.
Now, how does this translate outside of Havana, outside of big cities?
I think it's, unfortunately, as much as we have been trying to decentralize the country, it's a very difficult task. I mean, Havana remains as the center of the country, not as other Latin American countries, as much as other Latin American countries, but it still is the center of the country and it still is the most cosmopolitan city. But we have other important cities in the country too, like Santiago de Cuba or Cienfuegos or Matanzas. But Havana is the
center. Or our sister city, Holguín, perhaps?
Holguín is a very important city, without any doubt. But nevertheless, you know very well, Havana is still the center. It's the most cosmopolitan city in this in the country. And all the artists want to live in Havana, and it's those that live in Havana have the best chances to be promoted and everything.
The situation which you describe, in which you have the audiences, the dance, for example, the dancers influencing the musicians, the audiences influencing the playwrights and directors and actors influencing the theater, that is a very much of an interactive cultural environment that we could only envy in this country, really, because it seems like, I mean, does it serve the purpose of actually bringing people together across racial backgrounds and, well, I don't know, what you're not supposed to have classes, but you do, you know, class backgrounds and so on in Cuba?
I wish it was much more, but certainly it is a way to talk about this kind of relationship between different artists, different specialists.
And from an outsider visitor's point of view, it seems like there is a very cohesive artistic community, and maybe that's a result of the fostering of arts education that happens in Cuba, where people are classmates at the Instituto Superior de Arte or at one of the other academies. Because if you really aspire to work in the arts, whether it's dance, music, theater, visual arts, and this is the track that you're on, you're going to cross paths with people from other disciplines. And if you stay with it and have a limited amount or a measured or a large amount of success, you're going to have colleagues in all of these areas. And, you know, there's a wonderful song by Silvio Rodriguez, and he was how could I describe Silvio Rodriguez? He's Bob Dylan, Paul Simon, and several others all in one. Yes, yeah, and there's a great song about him traveling on an old train to Camagüey in the interior of the country because a friend of his, who's a playwright, asked him to write the music for the play, and he's looking out the window and describe. It's a poetry, just his train ride. But you get a sense that there is this camaraderie between artists. That here's an artist in Havana, who's a well-known musician, and here's a friend of his in a smaller town, who's a playwright, and they're going to get together. And you know, really, that's what an art community is about. That sort of European bohemianism still exists. And maybe it's born out of the fact that there isn't a big market, that it isn't like you're going to be able to go buy a new Porsche when you sell your show. It isn't about that. It's everybody understands that their financial success is going to be limited in some way. And so you look at other things. You know, there's other things. If you want to have a dinner party and there isn't a lot of food to eat, it's not about the food. It's about the people that are going to come together. And I think that's something that has developed culturally in Cuba over the last 50 years. You know, the austerity has resulted in a very positive thing. You know, if you don't have TV, you read a book. That's what's happened. And so people read books.
If you have the book.
Right.
Okay. No, I don't want to sound too much optimistic. I live in Cuba, so I want to criticize what must be criticized. This is a goal, certainly, that everybody comes together, that a kind of balkanization is very bad for the development of culture, for the development of the arts. But I wish we were more closer than we are, living inside Cuba. I wish we had less race barriers that we have, still have.
You still have racial barriers.
Absolutely, because listen to this. Legally, racism is absolutely forbidden in Cuba, of course. When I was a kid, when I was a child, I never remember being in the same place as a black person. But after the revolution, everything changed, legally. But culturally, things take much more time to change. And I think that we have to always be aware of that. We have to be thinking about that all the time, not to have a racist behavior in any way. So I wish we were much more closer across the different arts and the different kind of people that we are. Nevertheless, compared with any other country that I have visited, yes, this is the truth regarding Cuba. It's a great relation, a great community, really. Not only among the artists, but also among the artists and the doctors, for instance, among the artists and all the professionals. People is very well connected. People like to talk. People like to find a way to meet and to talk.
Now, what is the movie industry like right now in Cuba?
It was a movie industry in Cuba until 1990. We had that. And it was formally directed by the ICAIC, the Institute of Cuban Cinema. But then, since we didn't have the money enough to produce that, a lot of freelancers started to produce their own films by themselves, using simple camera, computer to edit it. Now we have a very massive movement of small productions all over the country that I think is very alive and I think is very strong.
What is the connection between the arts in Cuba right now, whether it be the visual arts or dance and so on, and the rest of Latin America? I mean, we're so isolated and cut off. But what about your connections with Venezuela, Peru, Argentina, and so on?
I don't think we used to have at the very beginning of the 60s and still until the 70s, a very strong cultural connection with most of the Latin American countries. In fact, the boom of the Latin American novel took place mainly connected with the Casa de las Americas, a Cuban institution. All the big writers in America and the big painters, like Mata and all of them, came to Havana. Havana was like the cultural capital of the continent. It's not the same in those days, but we have a lot of people working in countries like Venezuela, Ecuador, Nicaragua, and Central America. As well as we have doctors, we also have artists, and we also have art teachers, art instructors, training people or developing what we could call community art. I don't think the results, we could say, are always the best results in the world, but we are trying to establish, to preserve the relations that we already had and to establish relations with the new people in these countries.
And so what have you been doing during your visit here in New Mexico?
I didn't speak anything about the foundation, but the goal of the foundation have been really to create the possibility for the Cuban artist to be promoted in the right way and to have an institution that they could respect, that they could consider their institution. At the same time, we try to reestablish bridges with the rest of the world in the proper way, mainly with the most important institutions in the United States. This relation was broken for a long time, so we are trying to reestablish that. We even have a partner organization in the United States called the American Friends of Ludwig Foundation of Cuba. So we have been developed cultural exchange programs with the most important American institution. We receive every year American students for a full semester in Cuba from various universities. For instance, from Tisch School of the Arts in NYU comes every spring semester to teach documentary filmmaking and photography in Cuba to their students. At the same time, young Cuban people take the classes too. So it's a very interesting program we are trying to develop. In these days in New Mexico, what I'm trying to do is, first of all, learning about who you are, about what this beautiful place is. Second, looking for chances to establish exchange programs with this state, people like you, all of you. And that's why I was talking about the development of Cuban art, the possibilities that Cuba have to work in this exchange. In this very difficult political moment that we are living between the two countries, I think that culture is the field in which we could go further. And we must do it. We have the responsibility to develop that. I mean, both sides, not only the Cubans.
Elmo Hernandez is the Elmo Hernandez is the president of the Fundación Ludwig de Cuba, the Ludwig Foundation of Cuba, and the friends of this foundation can be found on the web at aflfc.org. Stuart Ashman is the Cabinet Secretary for Cultural Affairs for the state of New Mexico. Thanks both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm very happy now to welcome photographer Victoria Sambunaris. She will be speaking this coming Thursday, the 11th of November, at Tipton Hall at 6 o'clock, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute right here in Santa Fe. It's part of the Art Institute series, Elemental, Earth, Air, Fire, Water, Art as Environment. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having me on your show.
So your photographs are of landscapes. They're landscape photographs, most of which show signs of human intervention of one kind or another. How and where did you start doing this work?
I have to attribute this to my background, because why landscape? Almost everyone I know photographs people, and there are no people in my photographs. But I go back to my childhood, and I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where industry was set against an agricultural landscape. It's the home of the Amish. And my parents were Greek immigrants, and they came to the United States in the 50s. And I grew up in a Greek neighborhood, working-class Greek neighborhood in Lancaster. And we used to take Sunday drives out to the countryside. And I have memories of those drives and seeing Lancaster, the landscape, going out to the country. And somehow that's filtered into my work, I have to say. And my father was an amateur photographer as well, so I think it has to come from all of that.
Some of the pictures that you take in are railroad subjects. There's dams, there's mines, there's cities. What attracts you? So you're out driving, you spend a lot of time in the car. How do you decide when you're going to stop and start working?
Well, early, I've been doing these trips for 10 years. So basically what I do is when I first started, I would just go out into the landscape. I would figure out the destination, some particular part of the country. But as time evolved, I became more project-oriented, and I'm looking at something more specific. But early on, my first trip was down on the Texas border, and I was looking at all the NAFTA industry, and I was interested in ideas of the American dream, and which is what brought my parents to this country, to grasp that and to instill it in their children. And so I was down looking at the maquiladoras in Laredo, looking at these minimal boxes on the landscape. And industry is part of, for me, industry, suburban landscapes, government campuses. It was all part of the American dream. It was a more literal idea of the American dream. And so that's where I began. And most recently, I've been back on the border looking at the landscape of the fence and areas that where the fence hasn't been built, like the Rio Grande area.
How does your parents' view of the American dream differ from yours?
Well, there were expectations in my life for what, well, for what we were going to do. I mean, doctors, lawyers, and business people is what I think my parents had hoped. And that just wasn't really fitting into my agenda. And so photography was a passion that I had since I was 14. And I did my undergrad in business, but I just kept returning to photography. And it was the vehicle to get me out of a world that was being created for me. And it got me on the road, and it got me out into the country to discover place and to discover the country, which is so diverse and which makes it so great, you know. And everyone has a story. Everyone has an opinion. Everyone got here from somewhere. And that's fascinating to me.
And yet there's no people in your photographs.
The people are in the background. They're what helps me get to place. Like when I come into a town, I start talking to people and I hear their stories. And it's part of the project, but it's not what you see. And I want the viewer to see the photographs and form their own opinions and bring something of themselves to the work. And all the stories and the people, that's something that I hold on to for myself. It's funny, but on this trip, I've been videotaping people talking about the history of place, about their opinions, their backgrounds. And it's been really interesting. I'm not sure what I'll do with that, but maybe it's something I'll just keep for myself for referencing, but maybe I will end up doing something with it. I'm not sure.
Do you feel like your photographs tell a story? In other words, do they speak for themselves? Do you provide stories along with the photographs when you display them?
I don't. I feel like photojournalism does that. Photojournalism is revealing something to the world, and it's communicated, but I want the viewer to bring their own stories. No one can imagine the stories behind my own stories behind the photographs and what happens to get to this place. But I want you to get lost in them, in the way that you do maybe a painting, you know.
It's fun. Nobody can imagine, but it would be so interesting, I would think. I mean, having looked at your photographs just so far on the web, it seems like for each one there's a background, and one would really love to know what happened and where you were and what they mean on some level other than what we can project onto it.
Yeah, the stories are good, I have to say. And I do tell the stories, and maybe that will come in a book or something down the line. There's a lot of information. I keep diaries and journals, and I do, in addition to, I shoot with a large format camera, big 5x7 camera, but I also carry with me a smaller medium format camera they're more diaristic, they're looser, they're the towns that I'm in, some of the people that I meet, They tell the story. Maybe the video that I'm doing as well tells a little bit of the story. Maybe that will come later. But for now, this is what I want to give to the world.
One of your inspirations is the author John McPhee. Tell us how he influenced your work.
While I'm traveling, I'm trying to understand what I'm looking at. I'm not a geologist, and a lot of what I'm looking at is geology, a lot of mining operations. And I don't know how. I was reading some of his books, and I bought Annals of the Former World, and this was years back. And I kept that book in the car, and when I was driving through Nevada and trying to understand basin and range, he spelled it out in his books. And so I was always inspired by his work. And in some ways, he taught me to be more open, to tap into the culture of a place. And so I had this book in the car for many years, and eventually, I guess it was in 2007, I decided to tackle that book and try to make a body of work inspired particularly by that book, because he travels I-80 from New Jersey to San Francisco over the course of 20 years with geologists. And it's a great, great book. And so I thought, this has been such an important book to me. I think
And when you start doing that, when you start focusing on the geology of a place, for example, it's such a different thing than a kind of like romantic landscape type of photograph.
Yes, it is. But for instance, I started, one of the first places I stopped was in a coal mine in Pennsylvania. And I thought, why is there coal here? What happened here in geological time 360 million years ago? What did this landscape look like? And John McPhee spells it out in the book, but I'm imagining what this tropical landscape looked like, and now we have coal,
right,
that fuels us. And then you can continue with that thought and think about how it literally fuels the city. It's our electricity. I mean, it goes on and on.
Victoria Sambonaris is a photographer, and she will be speaking this coming Thursday, the 11th of November, at Tipton Hall on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. It's at 6 o'clock, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute, and it's part of the Art Institute's series called Elemental Earth, Air, Fire, and Water, Art as Environment. We're so looking forward to seeing you here.
Thank you. I look forward to arriving in Santa Fe.
Thanks. Thanks for being with us. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.